ever since I've ever heard music, I thought it should be very clean, very precise, as clean as possible anyway, you know. And more or less to the people, you know, something they could understand, something that was beautiful, you know.
Charles Yardberg Parker. That's the name of a musical revolution, as well as a shy young man from Kansas City, who used the alto saxophone as a tool to change the way musicians would forever speak, not just in America, but around the world. His music spoke of freedom, of promise, of the future. And yet he himself was imprisoned by drugs for more than half his short life. Many books have documented that life. Clint Eastwood brought the story in all its tragic detail to the big screen. He died at age 34 in the New York apartment of a European baroness, broke, tired, and alone. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles. For the next hour, part one of a two-part show on one of the great stories of the 20th century, a tribute to Charlie Parker. Bird Lives. Just about everything about the man's approach to music was remarkable. He was a self-taught innovator who could fly higher and cut deeper than any other musician of his day. Many folks, players and fans alike, were swept away by the musical advances he pioneered, like the upper harmonic intervals and the multiple polyrhythms. But what made his sound so powerful and his voice so recognizable was that he never strayed very far from the blues. He always told a very human story. They called his music bebop. It was a word whose meaning could only be fathomed by listening to the music of Charlie Parker and his colleagues. Author of Celebrating Bird, The Triumph of Charlie Parker, Gary Giddens.
I think when you're trying to evaluate Charlie Parker's importance in jazz and in American music, it's difficult to overestimate the influence that he had. There's really no place where you don't see it, because chiefly he changed the way we listen to harmonies. He made the whole concept of harmony more complicated so that there's a greater harmonic palette for all of these musicians to use. He completely changed rhythm so that it became faster, a brisk, furious kind of a canter based more on the eighth note than on the quarter note. And then he enriched the music with a whole new vocabulary of melodic phrases.
Jazz historian Stanley Crouch.
Well, you know, the first thing I think that anybody should recognize about Charlie Parker is that a great deal of what we now take for granted in terms of instrumental technique, phrasing, melodic invention, is the result of the way in which he reinterpreted the jazz tradition at the time that he arrived in the middle 40s. So that when you hear John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Ornette Coleman, many, many saxophone players, at least 50% of what you hear them playing is a result of what Charlie Parker played.
Vibraphonist Milt Jackson.
He had such dexterity, such fluidity in his playing. If you take his nickname, Bird, and you picture a bird flying through the air, you know, in flight, he's totally free, right? And if you listen to his playing, even though the music is structured, once you listen to him play, his style of playing is so totally free that he could just go in any direction that he so desired.
Thank you. Charlie Parker's wife from the mid-40s to the early 50s, Doris Parker.
His instrument was definitely an integral part of him. He was almost synonymous with his horn. In fact, when he died, Dizzy and I were looking at his hands because they were curved. And he often held his hands that way, curved, just as if he had his horn in his hands with his fingers curved. He never sat with his hands straight out.
I think the thing that moves me the most about Charlie Parker is his tone.
Musician, conductor, and author, Gunther Schuller.
When he played the blues, slow blues or fast blues, it doesn't matter, that tone is to me the most beautiful saxophone tone that's ever been produced by anybody.
Stanley Crouch.
Charlie Parker was a man from what was the blues belt of the Southwest, which was Kansas City, and Kansas City players were notorious for their ability to play the blues with great eloquence at any tempo. They could play remarkably good slow blues, they could play medium tempo blues, they could play kind of bouncing dance blues, they could play fast blues. And so Charlie Parker completely absorbed the blues sensibility of Kansas City.
If you think the blues have to be about hard times, you're wrong. Especially in Kansas City during the 30s, the blues was party music. Like they used to say, it hurts so nice. And there was no Great Depression in Kansas City either, because the gangsters were in league with the politicians to keep the place wired 24 hours a day. In a 5-block radius not far from where Charlie Parker grew up, there were over 50 nightclubs that featured music well into the dawn. As the Depression drove the large swing bands off the road, many musicians found their way to Kansas City. Writer Gary Giddens.
There was an extremely corrupt politician named Pendergast, Boss Pendergast. And he was one of those slick ward heelers who basically sold everything to mobsters who came down frequently from Chicago. And they opened up all the kinds of clubs and joints that you can only have in a wide open town. I mean, all of those clubs had to have musicians, and there were dozens of clubs. And in those days, you know, you didn't hire a quintet. You hired a big band. That was the sound.
Stanley Crouch.
So for jazz musicians, and as for any musicians in Kansas City, there was a lot of work. And the thing is that in an improvised music like jazz, the more a musician plays, the better he gets, because the more time he spent with his instrument in his hands working on it, the better he sounds, because he learns how to fit into many, many different contexts. He becomes more and more familiar with different kinds of chord combinations. So all of those things are great. And once Charlie Parker jumped into that situation sometime in the mid to late 30s, he was in an environment that was perfect for him to really pick up things very quickly.
Charlie Parker was born August 29th, 1920. His father was an itinerant song and dance man who deserted the family when vaudeville work dried up. So Charlie was raised in a small frame house by his mother. Addie Parker worked nights as a cleaning woman, leaving the 14-year-old, who was supposed to be doing his homework, to prowl the nightclubs down on 12th and Vine until the early hours. There, peering over the transom at the Sunset Club, or pressing his ear to the wall of the Cherry Blossom, he witnessed firsthand the great saxophone revolution of the 30s. Needless to say, after 3 years, he was still a freshman at Lincoln High School. But in the world of jazz, he had matriculated and was about to graduate on the honor roll.
Mm-hmm.
Lester Young with Count Basie's band playing Lady Be Good. Both the song and the man would return at key points in Charlie Parker's life. The song briefly, the man eternally. For it was Lester Young's fresh ideas and crying sound that provided a spiritual and musical role model for the young Charlie Parker. Other influences included Jimmy Dorsey, not a great improviser, but someone who played the alto saxophone with speed and a soulful tone, as well as saxophonist Chewberry and trumpeter Roy Eldridge, who were both modernists of their day. Kansas City had a tradition of after-hours jam sessions. It was a place to prove your capability as a musician. There is a well-told story about one of these jam sessions that involves Count Basie's drummer, Papa Joe Jones, and the young Charlie Parker. Apparently, Charlie was struggling badly to keep up with the other musicians at the session. In response, Papa Joe removed one of his cymbals and threw it on the floor in front of Parker, where it made a loud crash. It was a wordless review that spoke loudly to everyone in the room. As a result of the failed jam session, Charlie Parker's resolve was hardened. "I'll fix these cats," he told his friend, bassist Gene Ramey. "They're laughing at me now, but I'll be back." He then began to intensify his studying. In this rare radio interview with saxophonist Paul Desmond and disc jockey John McClellan from the early 50s, Charlie Parker talks about the long hours of work that changed his playing.
"I put quite a bit of study into the horn, that's true. Mm-hmm. In fact, the neighbors threatened to ask my mother to move once when I was living out west. I mean, they said I was driving them crazy with the horn. I used to put in at least 11 to 15 hours a day."
"Yeah, that's what I wondered."
"Well, that's true, yes. I did that for over a period of 3 or 4 years."
"Oh.
Yeah.
I guess that's the answer."
"Oh, definitely. Study is absolutely necessary in all forms. It's just like any talent that's born within somebody. It's just like a good pair of shoes when you put a shine on it, you know? Schooling brings out the polish, you know, of any talent that happens anywhere in the world. Einstein had schooling, but he has a definite genius, you know, within himself."
There's little doubt that Buster Smith, known as Professor in Kansas City, was a major influence on the young Charlie Parker. Jazz producer and radio host Phil Schaap.
The earliest books about Charlie Parker, notably The Legend of Charlie Parker, The Oral History, find that Byrd and everyone else knew that he dug a Kansas City musician who obviously helped younger players. You could tell in his nickname, they called him Prof. Buster Smith.
Charlie Parker's first trip to New York City when he was just 19 years old was in search of Buster Smith, who had gone ahead only weeks before. Of course, once he arrived in the Big Apple, many things came to him, including a musical vision which would help him shape the future of jazz music. Gary Giddens.
He had to leave Kansas City. There was no future for him. First of all, by the time he left, the Pendergast regime, Pendergast was in jail, and Kansas City was no longer a wide open town, and so it was drying up, and all the musicians were making ready to leave.
Shortly after he arrived, Charlie Parker got a job washing dishes at Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem, a job he took specifically because Art Tatum was the house pianist there. He stayed as a dishwasher for a couple of months just so he could hear Tatum, who was one of the most harmonically advanced jazz musicians of the time. This, too, was an important part of Byrd's musical matriculation. Thank you. Trumpeter, Wynton Marsalis.
Charlie Parker figured out how to solo. He plays more like a piano player, like Art Tatum. Well, the horn players generally just invent melodies and wouldn't put a lot of alternate chord progressions. I guess Coleman Hawkins would, so he's one of the first saxophonists to play like a piano player. But with Charlie Parker, you have that to the nth degree. Coleman Hawkins, he would mainly do that on ballads. And every now and then he might do it on an up-tempo song, but Charlie Parker would put what we call chord substitutions. He could substitute chords on any type of material. He also had the melodic vocabulary to go with it. Whereas when Coleman Hawkins was playing, he would play a lot of arpeggios. Charlie Parker, he'd figure out how to construct a melodic line through that type of a harmonic progression.
During this first trip to New York, Parker continued his playing, jamming for pennies wherever they would let him sit in. During one of these sessions, he had a revelation that became the foundation for the new jazz that was to come. The words of Charlie Parker, taken from Downbeat magazine in 1950.
I remember one night I was jamming in a chilly house on 7th Avenue between 139th and 140th. It was December 1939. Now, I'd been getting bored with the stereotype changes that were being used all the time at that time, and I kept thinking there's bound to be something else. I could hear it sometimes, but I couldn't play it. Well, that night, I was working over Cherokee, and as I did, I found that by using the higher intervals of a chord as a melody line and backing them with appropriately related changes, I could play the thing I'd been hearing. I came alive.
You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. I'm Nancy Wilson. Before his 20th birthday, Charlie Parker became a vital member in the last of the swing-era big bands to emerge from Kansas City, the J. McShann Orchestra. He finally had a platform to reach a national audience, and when he did, during a brief solo on McShann's recording called Hootie Blues, he changed musical history. It may not sound so radical today, but at the time, many musicians, upon hearing these few bars, knew that something very new was in the wind, and its name was Charlie Parker. Hootie Blues, the J. McShann Orchestra featuring Charlie Parker, recorded April 30th, 1941. While out on the road with the McShann Band, somewhere out in the wilds of Nebraska, the car that Charlie Parker was riding in hit a chicken. Sounds like a small incident, until you realize that it gave us one of the most famous nicknames in jazz, J. McShann.
We were playing at Nebraska University in Lincoln that one night. So we were driving up in automobiles, you know. So in the car that Bird and them were in, you know how you're driving on the highway and when you pass these houses, the farmer's chickens would run outside of the highway, you know. So they ran, a couple of chickens ran out there and the car hit them. So Bird looked back in the back, said, "Hey man, you hit these yard birds up here. Drive back up and go back. I want to pick these yard birds up." So the guy backed the car up. Bird got out and got the chicken. Seeing back in those days, you see, we couldn't stay at downtown hotels, you know. We had to stay at families, you know, black families. So when Bird stayed at some lady's house named Bertha, Miss Bertha. And so he took these chickens in there and asked her, would she cook them? So she said, yeah, I'll fix them for you. And she cooked the chickens for him, and Bird didn't let nobody have none of that chicken. He kept it all to himself. So it was Yardbird then, and it stuck with him.
Eventually, the McShann Band arrived in New York City for an extended stand at Harlem's legendary Savoy Ballroom. The engagement was broadcast on NBC Radio, and the band's opening night, auspiciously Friday the 13th of February 1942, was heard by musicians all over the country. It was Bird's first real gig in New York City, and it made a lasting impression.
Charlie Parker's New York City debut happened to be at the most important ballroom in the history of jazz.
Phil Shapp.
In the midst of this challenge, Charlie Parker and the J. McShann Orchestra elect to play a tune that everyone knows. Kindergarten teachers lay it on all the kids, and most of us sing it very slowly as a waltz. Bird played it up-tempo in 4-4. And on top of that, which sounds hip in the first place, he plays what you could say is his greatest solo to date because of the integration of his musical revolution to the hip gesture of doing I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles as a jazz vehicle, to the integration of soloists to the ensemble, it's still a big band deal, and to flourishes and details.
Gary Giddens.
By the second, third night that he was there, even by the late show of the first night, I believe, musicians started coming up from 52nd Street. And important musicians, like Ben Webster, started talking about him. Who is this young guy? So he had an almost instantaneous impact in that sense.
I'm a striver from up on Strivers Row, and I'm jiving the very best I know, but hot times got things topsy-turvy.
At the same time Charlie Parker was with McShann's band, a trumpet player in Cab Calloway's orchestra was working on a musical concept similar to Bird's. Dizzy Gillespie originally met Charlie Parker when Cab's band worked in KC. Dizzy Gillespie.
I was playing with Cab Calloway, and we played Kansas City. I knew Buddy Anderson, a young trumpet player down there. Buddy would be there to meet me when the bus pulled up, you know. And we'd be hanging out, and we'd blow together, and we'd play in the hotel room and everything. So this time, I came to Kansas City, he said, man, you got to hear this guy, saxophone player. And I started thinking, saxophone player? I played with Don Byers, Leslie Young, Ike Quebeck, Ben Webster, all these guys. I said, saxophone player? He said, yeah, I want you to hear this guy. I said, okay.
Pianist and trumpeter Buddy Anderson.
Bird showed up, and they met, and we went around to the foundation and jammed a few tunes. Dizzy played piano, and I played trumpet, and Bird played his horn. Dizzy didn't play anything, you know, on the trumpet. He just listened to see what was going on.
We played all day in the hotel until almost time to go to work that night. I was completely convinced that here was the you know, like I said, somebody looking for Jesus to come and religion. He was like that boy. Played the blues like nobody else in the world. Fast as anybody else in the world. Keys didn't make no difference to him. So I said, there's the man.
In his radio interview with Paul Desmond and John McClellan, Charlie Parker recalls his first meeting with Dizzy.
Dizzy came by one night, I think at the time he was working with Cab Calloway's band. And he sat in the band, and I was quite fascinated with the fellow. And we became very good friends, and until this day we are, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first time I ever had the pleasure to meet Dizzy Gillespie.
Well, was he playing the same way then, before he played with you?
I don't remember precisely. I just know that he was playing a, what you might call in the vernacular of the streets, a buku of horn, you know?
Buku?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, just like all of the horn packed up in once, you know?
Before I met Charlie Parker, I was trying to play like Roy Eldridge. But when I heard the phrasing of Charlie Parker, I said, yeah, that's what I... And then I started adding my, what I thought, like the way that the music should go. And it developed into two definite styles of playing.
Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie next came together in a band led by Earl Hines in 1942. Charlie Parker.
I came back to New York again. I found Dizzy again in the Earl Hines organization. And I joined the band with him. I was in New York, and we both stayed on the band about a year. It was Earl Hines, Dizzy Gillespie, Sarah Vaughan, Billy Eckstein, quite a few names that you'd recognize in the music world today, you know, on that band.
At one point in 1944, Charlie Parker joined Dizzy Gillespie in the Billy Eckstein Band, the first real bebop band of which Dizzy was music director. The band included many of the great names in the new music revolution, including Fats Navarro, Miles Davis, Dexter Gordon, Art Blakey. Unfortunately, the band was never recorded with Charlie Parker. Just ahead, Bird and Dizzy continue to refine their new musical ideas in the clubs of New York City and make an ill-fated trip to Los Angeles. As part one of our two-part tribute to Charlie Parker continues, I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. When the Eckstein Band folded, Bird went back to New York City, where the climate was ripe for musical ferment. On the one hand, 52nd Street was jumping, with a row of upscale nightclubs featuring small groups led by jazz giants, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, Billie Holiday, and Slim Gaylor. But the style of these small groups was still based on the swing music of the big bands, and the big band smacked of conformity to the beboppers. The real musical revolution was going on uptown in Harlem at after-hours clubs like Monroe's and Minton's. There, Bird would play searching, impassioned solos all night long, making a few dollars in tips, never removing his dark sunglasses, keeping the world of daylight, of conformity, of show business at bay.
What Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Kenny Clark, and Oscar Pettiford and those people were really trying to do is they were trying to find a way to play that was interesting to them.
Jazz historian Stanley Crouch.
And they had everything hooked up except the way to phrase the music. They'd figured out the harmony up, you know, uptown. Dizzy and Thelonious Monk had figured that out. Kenny Clark had invented another drum style. And when Charlie Parker came into it, he had the phrasing that made the music really work.
Even though they had appeared in a couple of recording sessions together, Bird and Dizzy's first definitive bebop session took place in May of 1945. The two innovators were prime for the date, having refined their innovations while working at a club called the Three Deuces on New York's 52nd Street. It was the clearest indication to date of the melodic, harmonic, and rhythmic concepts that musicians would explore for the next 50 years. With Al Haig at the piano, Curly Russell on bass, Sid Catlett on drums, here's Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie with Sure Enough. Written and performed by Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Several months after recording Sure Enough, Charlie Parker was invited into the studio to record for one of the music's independent labels, Savoy Records. Because of some mix-up over the pianist, he asked Dizzy Gillespie to fill in at the keyboard. The session resulted in perhaps the greatest Parker recording of all time, Coco. Writer, Gary Giddens.
When I was teaching the history of jazz, and I would get to the bebop period and Charlie Parker, for several years I made the mistake of beginning with Coco. I would say, well, we're coming into a whole new era here, and I would play Coco. And what absolutely fascinated me is that the kids in the class were completely turned off by it. And this really impressed me, the idea that music that was made 40 or 50 years ago could still sound so avant-garde, so terrifying to people. Who loved everything else. I mean, they were with me through Hawkins and Young and Benny Goodman and Ben Webster, all the pre-bebop people. But when I heard Coco, now what is it about Coco? The way they originally started to record it is they played a series of arabesques that Parker wrote that are eight-bar exchanges between the alto saxophone and Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet. And then they go into the theme of Cherokee by Ray Noble. Bom, bom, do, dee, da, bom, bom, boo, bee, bom. Somebody stopping the session, and then they come back to do the classic Coco that we all know, and this time it's the same exact arrangement, but they leave out the theme. They leave out the Ray Noble tune. Basically, instead of saying, oh, you know, we're going to take a very conventional hit song that you've all heard a billion times and play variations on it, they created a complete abstraction of it, so that all you have is the arabesque, this unison phrase, and then bang! And there literally is a bang. Max Roach plays a bang, and it goes into Charlie Parker's solo at a tremendous velocity, a velocity that's, you know, yes, it's true, you can find a Barney Bagard solo that maybe played that fast, but he's playing on the beats, chop-a-ta, chop-a-ta, chop-a-ta. This is played at a supersonic velocity where there are no predictable beats. It's like a ping-pong ball, you know, being blown by a fan in a very small room, where he changes the accents on every measure, on every phrase.
Thank you.
And then after he plays his two choruses, Max Roach comes in for one chorus, and he keeps like a drum roll going against the time, and then he comes out of it with another bang, and then they play the arabesque and the unison theme and out. And I swear, the first time you hear it, it's, you know, like somebody dumped a bucket of ice water over your head, because it's not like anything that preceded it.
Coco, with Charlie Parker on alto saxophone, Dizzy Gillespie on piano and trumpet, Curly Russell on bass, and Max Roach on drums. That November 1945 session was also notable for another reason. It introduced a young trumpeter from St. Louis who would go on to become another musical icon in jazz. His name, Miles Davis. This new jazz being played and how it was being played polarized the jazz community. It was panned by critics. Even well-known players from the swing period reacted negatively to it.
The style of the music was so new to everybody.
Vibraphonist Milt Jackson.
You must remember, now, we were the musicians. It took us a minute or two to understand what was going on. So you can realize what the fans had to go through. They had to go through much more of it before they finally began to realize what was going on. Because at first, they didn't understand what we were doing.
And now, Gates, here's your chance to look before you leap. Hot from old New York and current and blasting their silly at Billy Berg's standing room comes the nation's sensational new jazz trumpet star and his cohorts, Dizzy Gillespie.
In 1946, Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker made the fateful decision to accept a two-month engagement at Billy Berg's nightclub in Hollywood. They took the train west, and one can only imagine their sense of anticipation as the countryside rolled by, every mile taking them further away from the nest and closer to the unknown in Los Angeles. Out on the West Coast, the jazz establishment seemed to hate everything the Dizzy and Bird stood for. Adding to Bird's anxiety was the fact that his heroin addiction had been growing along with his musical reputation. And there in Los Angeles, thousands of miles from his connections, it was perhaps inevitable that this would come to haunt him. Dizzy Gillespie.
I had a gig out in at Billy Berg's, California. And I organized another band with Ray Brown, Al Haig, Stan Levy, Yard, Milt Jackson. I mean, got Milt Jackson because we figured that if once Yard get out on the West Coast, he's gonna be late, and the guy's gonna take some money out and something like that. So I had the contract said five pieces, but I took six.
Dizzy Gillespie also hired tenor saxophonist Lucky Thompson, who sat in occasionally as the seventh member of the band. Whether it appeared as a sextet or septet, it was very clear that this ensemble was one of the best small groups in the history of jazz. That's Dizzy Gillespie's Groovin' High, recorded at Billy Berg's in Los Angeles in December of 1945, with Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, pianist Al Haig, bassist Ray Brown, drummer Stan Levy, and vibraphonist Milt Jackson. The engagement at Billy Berg's came to an end, and while Dizzy and the rest of the band collected their pay and flew back to New York City, Parker cashed in his plane ticket and decided to stay in L.A. Dizzy Gillespie.
Charlie Parker just stayed out there. I gave him his money, fare back to New York, and we left.
The newness of his presence on the L.A. scene soon began to wear thin, and he found himself scuffling at clubs like the Finale on Central Avenue. His drug addiction was becoming a major problem, and he was having trouble finding a good connection in L.A. Subsequently, he started to drink more, which only aggravated the problem. Perhaps it was his need for money that led him to approach a record store owner named Ross Russell and offer his exclusive services as a recording artist.
One night, I was about to close the store, and one of my customers came in, and he said, "Hey, man, I got Bird in the Short." Well, translated in English, that meant, "I've got Charlie Parker outside in my car, and he wants to talk to you." Oh, he brought Bird in. Well, Bird had a long list of complaints. He was sick of recording with Dizzy Gillespie. He didn't want to make any more of these up-tempo, frenetic records like Shaw Enough was one of them. Anyway, he didn't want to make any more records like that. He wanted to record his own material with sidemen of his own choosing. This was the basis of a contract.
A few days later, Ross Russell was launching his new company called Dial Records by recording four Charlie Parker classics, Moose the Mooch, Yardbird Suite, Night in Tunisia, and Ornithology. The session featured Miles Davis on trumpet, Lucky Thompson tenor saxophone, Arvin Garrison on guitar, Vic McMillan bass, and Roy Porter drums. Charlie Parker's first session for Dial Records also resulted in the shortest record he ever made, a 47-second outtake on Night in Tunisia that became known as the famous alto break. The drummer on that recording, Roy Porter.
Night in Tunisia, when you, there's an interlude where you get that da 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 till they get to the four-bar break. That's 12 bars. When you get to the break, there's four more bars to be played. So it's a 16-bar thing altogether with the break that Bird made. I used to sit up and just make a break, you just feel it. But man, what he did on that, those four bars, everybody, we had a hard time coming back in. And so MDD, Miles Dewitt Davis, said, "Well, look, okay, Bird, we tried it two or three times." So Bird said, Miles Davis said, "Well, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go over here by the piano and say, I'll bring it, my hand down when the four bars is over so you can come back in on the 17th bar. Right." And that's how that break was made.
Charlie Parker also wrote a tune in dedication to his drug dealer, Moose the Mooch. Inevitably, Moose the Mooch was arrested. And this turned Parker's difficulty securing the heroin he needed into an impossibility. He began drinking great quantities of cheap liquor to ease the pain of heroin withdrawal. By the time he entered the studio to do his next recording session for Dial Records, he was in grave trouble. Ross Russell.
Parker was in very bad shape physically and mentally, and the only thing keeping him afloat was Howard McGee, who had a scale job in a small club in L.A., and finally, Bird said that he wanted to make a session. So the studio, C.P. McGregor, was engaged, and everybody showed up. Anyway, he could hardly stand up. My lover man, I had to hold him up to keep him spinning around, going off mic. It was a hopeless date. Listen to the playbacks. The young guys in the store said that lover man should be released because it showed what a genius does when he's in hopeless physical condition. And the record was released, and now I don't know whether it was the right thing to do or not.
Immediately following the Lover Man session, Charlie Parker's physical and mental condition deteriorated quickly. He was obviously struggling with something that was even larger than his own enormous talent. After the session, he had gone back to his hotel. Soon he came downstairs to the front desk, naked. They put him back in his room. The next thing they knew, he'd set fire to his mattress. The fire department was called. The police picked him up and deposited him in the mental wing of the jail. Howard McGee and Ross Russell managed to get him sent to Camarillo State Hospital, which was a mental institution with a reputation as something of a country club. He later wrote a song about his stay there called Relaxing at Camarillo. When Bird emerged from Camarillo 6 months later, he was rested and healthy. He was ready to return to New York and put together his own band. Soon he would have that band take Europe by storm, return to America to be one of the first jazzmen ever to record with strings. And yet, he wasn't through with drugs. All this and more on the next hour of Jazz Profile. Our tribute to Charlie Parker is produced by Tim Owens. Our writer is Ben Sidran, with additional help from Phil Schapp. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. The post-production engineers are Bill McQuay, Soraya Muhammad, and Chuck Thompson. Our thanks to the NPR Bureau in New York, John DiLiberto, Chuck Haddix, and Bob Sakiel. Stations KCUR in Kansas City, KPBS in San Diego, KLON in Long Beach, and WBGO in Newark also gave us a hand. Special thanks to Rachel Lewis at Verve Records and Daniel Marks at Denon Records. Thanks also to Dan Morgenstern and the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers State University. The executive producers for NPR's Jazz Profiles are Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. For more information about this and other programs in our series, look for us at NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Support for this program comes from a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, saying that jazz is as pure as the life we live. So live it. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thanks for listening. To hear more programs in this series, go to npr.org/jazzprofiles.